You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving. At your desk. Maybe at the gym. But you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach. And see a rocket launch. Or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to Mena's Masterclass. It is not often you get to interview a childhood hero, so I was thrilled to interview Steve Waugh on the day his photography exhibition opened. It is called The Spirit of Cricket India and is taking place at the Hyatt Regency in Sydney. All the information on the exhibition and his book of the same title are in the show notes. Definitely check it out. Now, here is a cricketer that needs no introduction, Steve Waugh. All right, I'm here in the Hyatt Regency in Sydney with the great Australian captain, Steve Waugh. Steve, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Excellent.
Thanks very much for coming on. When I was watching you play and as an Australian player, you very much had a vision for the world. You would always, on tour, you know, write your diaries and take photos and, you know, you wanted to take in the world, and, you know, that seemed to be evident in this beautiful exhibition, The Spirit of Cricket in India. Where did that sort of vision come from? A boy from Bankstown?
Oh, I don't know. I think you're just exposed to different things. On my first tours to the subcontinent, and it was such a different world to what I was used to, and I found it fascinating. I guess I'm curious and inquisitive by nature. I love looking out the bus window, and I always sit up the front of the bus and see what was happening outside on the streets. And it was so different to coming from Panania in the western suburbs of Sydney. Always took a camera with me, took some photos. So I guess I was just interested in what was happening outside. And I figured after going on a number of tours, you know, that cricket was pretty hard work, playing professional cricket. And when you weren't successful, if you went back to the room and thought about cricket the whole time, you could get these negative thoughts in your head. So I wanted to get out, escape away from cricket, clear my head, did a bit of writing, did some photography, always tried to see the sights, meet some people, go out and try and embrace the culture. So it was a natural progression, sort of driven by the fact that I didn't want to stay in my room and just think about cricket 24/7.
Yeah, because Australian teams, you know, up until that point had sometimes been a bit shy about really immersing themselves in foreign cultures and stuff. So it really was a bit of a, you could really see that development.
Yeah.
And I think it helped.
Yeah, we're probably fortunate, and the players these days, you know, the hotels they stay in, the way they looked after the transport, just the flights flying business class. But back when I first studied, if you flew economy, you weren't necessarily staying at the best hotels. The food probably wasn't as good as it was these days. It was much more challenging circumstances and situations in the 60s, 70s, 80s and before that. So they're definitely spoiled these days compared to when I first started my career. So it was a little bit harder to get out there and embrace the culture when it wasn't as easy. Nonetheless, I think probably sometimes in those eras, maybe there was a bit of a siege mentality too, that, you know, it was tough, and when things went bad, you sort of exaggerated in your own mind. So it was a bit of both. It was definitely tough at a tour in those early days, but maybe the attitude wasn't as embracing as it is now.
You certainly see a different attitude now with all the players that they mix in the IPL and these different leagues. There seems to be a little bit more camaraderie between the players. Where did this sort of exhibition come from? What sort of motivated you to get into photography and start with India?
Again, I wanted to have some hobbies and pastimes besides cricket because you know, you needed to get away from it. So obviously writing a few books, taking photography was another interest I had. So I'd always taken a camera with me, taken lots of shots and hoped for the best. And back in those days, you had to wait for your film to get processed. And if I took shots on some tours, it maybe take 1 or 2 weeks. And I took a lot of shots on slide film because I use those for my books because it's better quality. So it would sometimes take even longer to get processed. So that was a bit of a hobby. But I could never really get out and take the photos I wanted to in the subcontinent because when you're in the Australian team, your fame is such that, you know, you can't step outside the hotel for longer than 10 seconds and you get inundated. So I couldn't really go out and wander the streets and take the shots I wanted to. So I had to wait till the profile wasn't as great as it was when I was playing, and that took probably 15, 20 years. And I went back 18 months ago and sort of snuck out there, and we managed to get, you know, impromptu shots on the side of the road. We'd pull up and see a cricket game, and I'd go out and try and take some photos. Obviously, people started to recognise you after a little while, and the give and take was, you know, let me take my photographs of you guys trying to showcase the spirit of cricket, and after that, we'll have a game of cricket. So everyone got what they wanted. I got the shots I wanted, and they had the game of cricket afterwards.
Yeah, they got to play cricket with Steve Waugh. What a dream for some of those Indians. I know you've got a very close relationship with India through your charity work and obviously your playing career. What did you learn when you were taking these photos about cricket in India?
I think it's pretty much the same worldwide, that, you know, cricket is a great level. It doesn't matter which background you're from, which colour you are, which race, which religion, how much money you got. When you have a game of cricket, it's a contest. It's one against, it's you against someone else, and you've got a good chance of succeeding as anyone. So everyone's equal when you start a game of cricket. You just need a bat and a ball. You can make the stumps up from, you know, putting a bit of chalk on the wall or putting a garbage can there or finding some bricks, make a stump. You can imagine where your field is and away you go. So it's really up to the imagination, your attitude and your commitment, and you can have a game. So it's pretty much the same. When I grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney, we'd find any space was available, we'd turn it into an imaginary cricket game, make up our own rules, and away you go.
Incredible. And I know you're working on a book now about cricket in Australia. How's that going?
Well, it's just started. I had the concept of doing the spirit of cricket India first, because I think that's sort of the almost a home of cricket, and where it's a religion, a bit like football in Brazil, I suppose, or golf in South Korea. You know, certain countries that just have are so passionate about one sport. But India's got its own way of playing cricket. Australia, we're pretty unique as well. I want to capture cricket on the beaches, cricket in the outback, people involved in the game, from the tea ladies at afternoon who prepare the afternoon teas at cricket, to the groundsmen, to people who are loyal to their clubs, maybe doing the scoring or the scoreboards. Going to see outback cricket. So I started a few weeks ago, did some portraits of Bob Simpson. Unfortunately, we lost Alan Davis, and he was going to be my first subject. I was literally 12 hours away from taking Alan's portrait, and he fell ill, which was a tragedy because he's one of my favourite cricketers and an all-time great. So I've just started. I got some backyard shots a few weeks ago. Yeah, I want to find out where are the great stories in Australian cricket. Hopefully people will tell me why cricket's important to them and why they should be in my next book.
Yeah, excellent. Was it good to see Simo?
It was. You know, he's you know, had some health issues, but, you know, really an icon of Australian cricket, really, when you think about it. You know, a captain, coach, selector, administrator, every part of the game he's been involved in. And, you know, and by coincidence, he's the only cricketer that was involved in both tied tests. He played in the first tied test against the West Indies, and he was coached when we were involved in the second tied test against India.
Yeah, he's left a huge legacy on the game. So, you know, I wanted to go through some of my favourite moments in cricket involving yourself. You know, I was lucky enough to be at some of the best, you know, followed the 99 World Cup, so thank you for that. Could have all ended in tears, but it didn't. So let's go back to my first memory of you, which is in 5th of January 1989 at the MCG, that catch off Roger Harper.
That's it. It's high. It's miles in the air. Hughes is coming around. And so it's high. It's a what a catch! That's the greatest catch. Oh, unbelievable, Stephen Waugh. Running backwards, almost colliding with Hughes down there and the side screen. What a catch.
Probably the best outfield catch you've ever seen.
Like, people now give all these people credit catching on the boundary with the rope. You literally had your life in your hand. You got Merv Hughes barreling towards you, 150 kilos. You got the sight screen. What sort of, I don't know, what's your memories of that moment?
Well, I guess I was playing that day. It would have been six. So I wouldn't have been able to catch because the ropes would have been well inside the boundary. But, yeah, back in those days, I mean, we did a lot of fielding practice under Bob Simpson again because, you know, he was just relentless in making us a better fielding side. And we did all our fitness by running around taking catches. So, you know, often we'd have these high balls where he'd pick one person out and you get 10 or 15 balls in a row where he'd hit as far as he could away from you. So you'd full stretch the catch and then you turn, you go the other way. Sometimes he'd hit above you and you have to run and then all of a sudden look up in the sky and try and take it. So it was literally one of those scenarios where Roger Harper, it was a slow ball of Craig McDermott, full swing, hit it way up into the night sky. And I knew instantly I had to run full pace and then turn around hopefully at the right time and look up and catch the ball because I couldn't afford to look at it all the way because I wouldn't have, you know, got to it. So head down, sprinting off, didn't think about anything else but catching the ball. Didn't see Merv Hughes, didn't see the side screen, didn't see the boundary. Totally focused and I looked up at precisely the right time and it just dropped into my hands like someone had dropped it from 6 inches away. It just fell into my hand perfectly. And at that time, I realised that, hang on, everyone's pretty close here. I better duck around the back of the side screen before I run into the fence. And really, I didn't give it much thought until I watched the replay later on. And clearly, I didn't learn too much because I ran into Jason Gillespie a few years later.
Yeah, different circumstances there. But that catch still holds up. You look at it on the replays, it's still incredible. You know, and it's really an era when the one-day team was like the rock stars of Australian cricket. You know, you and Dean Jones and those nights used to just light up Australian television. And, you know, sort of a really important era of one-day cricket for Australia.
Yeah, Dean Jones was the one that was the catalyst, really, particularly when he played at MCG. He owned that turf down there and he walked out. It was like, you know, the lead singer, like Mick Jagger on the Rolling Stones. He led the band and he took us out there and the place just lit up and it gave us an extra 10% playing in Melbourne when he was there. And his style of cricket was, you know, running between the wickets as hard as good, you know, throwing in the field, he'd dive around, throw the balls from the boundary over the stumps and he got the crowd going. Same with Merv Hughes, I guess, as well. But, yeah, Dean Jones was an incredible player. And, yeah, I guess looking back on it, one-day cricket was so popular back then. The night games were a big event. And for us, it was really tough because you wouldn't get back to the hotel till late. Adrenaline was still in your system. You couldn't get to sleep at 3 and 4 in the morning. And then we'd be on a plane the next morning and go to the next venue. So it was pretty full on.
A few sunglasses in the mornings.
Definitely.
It looked like you had a lot of fun playing with Dino, especially batting. I remember, I think that summer, at the end, last 10 overs of a game against the West Indies at the SCG, you scored quite a few runs in a partnership. You two seemed to really gel together at the crease.
Yeah, I enjoyed batting with him because we love running between the wickets. We're both quick between the wickets. We took on the opposition. It was never a backward step with Dino. He was always, let's take him on, let's up the ante, let's control the match, you know, play with hustle, let's put pressure on the opposition. So I liked the way he played the game, and you know, he's never short of confidence. So you sometimes just get in the slipstream behind him and go with the flow.
Yeah, he sadly missed.
For sure.
Terrible loss for Australian cricket. So from there, it led into the 1989 Ashes tour, and you went over with a test average in the mid-30s, came back, test average in the 40s, a couple of brilliant hundreds at Headingley and Lords. What do you think clicked in that tour for you?
I think we were just all pretty relaxed for some reason. I don't know, it was a good bunch and it just all happened in that first test match at Headingley. Mark Taylor got a century in his second or third test and I thought, well, why haven't I got one? I've been playing 25 tests. Pick up your game. And for some reason it relaxed me and I played, you know, really good innings, got my first 100, and I was off and running, and then it was just like a snowball effect. Everyone played their best cricket. We were total underdogs. We won that series 4-0. We would have won it 6-0 except for the rain. And that was against a pretty good England side with a lot of really great players. So, you know, that was an exceptional tour. We got on really well. We spent 4.5 months together. We played 13 county games, I think, plus some one day. So it was just non-stop cricket, and we just tried to beat everyone. The county games, we just said, let's start winning. Let's get in the habit of winning. And that's when we changed the mentality of that side by just, you know, being ruthless. Even in the games that probably didn't matter as much, we wanted to play as well as we could.
Yeah, I still remember that back foot drive to bring up the 100. Tried to play it in the nets, not quite as successfully. So then actually, you know, after that you were dropped from the test side and you had a little bit of a sort of gap between, I think at the end of the summer after. And I remember I was training with Waverley Grade Cricket Club and I got in a car with a first grader to go to the other oval and he said, who's your favourite cricketer? And I said, Steve Waugh. And he said, oh, don't think we'll see him in the test side again. And I wish I could remember that guy's name, but I can't.
Yeah. Well, he might own up now when he listens to this.
Yeah, so it was the 2nd of January 1993. Yeah. You'd been recalled into the side to face the Windies. You were batting at 3. And I remember this brilliant 100, an even 100 against the West Indies. It was a terrific innings.
3 runs away now from what would be a very good 100.
It's well played. They may go for 3 here. This could be Stephen Waugh's first 100 against West Indies in Test cricket. Back he comes. He's flying down the wicket. That's his century.
You know, from that point around then, your test average, you know, in your first 37 tests or something, it was an average around 35. And then your next 120 tests, you average almost 60 with the bat. Did you do anything in that sort of period out of the side?
Yeah, I think, again, Bob Simpson was an influence. He sort of admonished me one time in the net saying, look, you're practicing to get out in the game. Because I go into the nets and I play some, you know, great shots and play, you know, a full repertoire of shots, get out a few times and think I had a good session. He goes, no, well, that's, you've had some nice shots, but you got out a number of times and the way you practice is the way you're going to play. So that stuck in my mind. And from that moment on, I played every net session like it was a test match. Whoever was bowling to me, I imagined where the fieldsmen were, try and hit in the gaps and try and play as if I was in a test match. So all of a sudden, when it really counted, you could reproduce under pressure pretty easily. So it was a way I trained, which was a change. I no longer wanted to look really great and score fantastic 30s and watch everyone else score the runs. I wanted to, you know, be batting and not be in the change room watching everyone else score runs. So I probably got a bit more ruthless, managed my game a bit differently, became more professional, and once I knew I could score runs, then it became a habit.
You certainly did. 30-odd test hundreds after that. Then sort of fast forward to the West Indies tour of 1995. So as a fan, the 93 loss in Adelaide by one run was just heartbreaking. On the edge of the Frank Worrell Trophy, border in there, good family friend Ian McDonald was the manager. We're all thinking it was going to happen and it didn't. Yeah, so yep. I can imagine how upset the team was. But then you head to the West Indies in 1995 and it's the famous Jamaica test, 200, 230 with your brother. Just an incredible performance that lives on in the ages.
That could go for 4. There's a long chaser on for Kenny Benjamin, who's picked it up rather late. They could run 4 here. Kenny Benjamin is not the fastest of fielders in the West Indies team, and they'll come for the 4th, which will bring him up his 200.
What a magnificent effort. One of the greatest moments in his career. We've got Australians running out from everywhere here.
When you brought up the 200 and saw Greg Ritchie running towards you, what did you think?
I didn't expect it, that's for sure. It was just, it was like the cavalry running out to the middle of the pitch. And
a few runs.
That cat had a few runs under his belt. And I think he jumped from out of the stand and hurt himself. So he had blood over his hands and mud. So he patted me on the shoulder and there was blood and dirt. And I could smell the rum. It was like, I thought, this is a bit strange. And then there was someone else had a didgeridoo playing a didgeridoo on the pitch. And another guy had the red Sharon footy, AFL footy, bouncing it on the pitch. It was like Australia had taken over for a couple of minutes and the West Indies players are looking around going, what is going on here? I mean, Richie couldn't believe that Greg Ritchie was out in the middle. He sort of said, fat cat, what are you doing, man? What are you doing out here?
You're a former test cricketer.
So it was just, one of those crazy, funny situations that would never happen now with professional sport and people not being allowed on the grounds. But back then. It was all tasered. The Aussies were so excited. I think they've been drinking a bit of rum on the sidelines and enjoying themselves.
Yeah, and was that tour and that innings in particular almost like your Mount Everest against that fearsome West Indian attack, a team that had been undefeated for almost 20 years? Was that kind of your Everest moment?
Both for myself and the team, you know, we knew that opportunity. We didn't want to waste another opportunity. We felt as if Adelaide was a bit of a wasted chance. West Indies were sort of, you could see they were declining a little bit, and we felt it was our time to take the number one mantle, and we let that slip in Adelaide. So the second opportunity came around. It's now or never. Someone's got to take this number one ranking off the Windies. We should do it. Let's do it. Mark and myself had that, obviously, a great partnership. We played a really good test. Won that series and then never looked back from that moment on. But sometimes you don't take those moments. But we trained all our life to beat the best in the toughest situation under the most pressure when it counted at the most. And that was that test match. So it all came together. So if I look back and say what's the most important innings of my career, that I think that 200 was both personally and from a team point of view the most important.
It's hard to think that the West Indies haven't won a series against Australia since then. If you'd said that to you then, I think you probably wouldn't have believed them.
No, they had a huge decline, and so quickly it wasn't great for world cricket. It was sad to see, actually. I mean, I want to see a good West Indies side because their spectators are so knowledgeable, so much fun, and it was a great tour together, the West Indies, the Caribbean. You really felt like you're in the Lions down there, and it was just a cauldron, and if you could perform there, you knew you were going okay in Test match cricket. But it's obviously changed since then. They lost focus, and Test cricket probably wasn't their priority. It became more T20, so I'd love to see them strong again. They've got a bit of talent, but it's going to be hard because there's so much money in T20 cricket now that, you know, why would you put yourself on the line and be vulnerable and fragile in Test cricket when you can make a lot more money and it's a lot easier playing T20?
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of economic pressure in the West Indies. What about Curtly Ambrose? As a spectator, he was just fearsome. It just never seemed to bowl a bad ball. Steep bounce. What was he like? I know he didn't talk to the opposition. Have you ever, like, talked to him since then?
Yeah, we've met a number of times. I get on really well with Curtly, but you're right. He never said a word to you. The only person he talked to was a captain, and he would just say captain as he walked past the captain. And so he was very intimidating. You talk about sledging. Yeah, the toughest opponent is someone that doesn't say anything, just looks at you like a Curtly Ambrose. And that West Indian attack, they rarely said much to you, but you knew you were up against it, and were they trying to get you out, were they physically going to hurt you, that was probably much more intimidating. So, great athlete, outstanding bowler, and one of the best to play the game.
Yeah, definitely. So from there, you know, Australia went on a great run. And then you took over the captaincy in early 1999, went back to the West Indies, 2-2 draw. But then it was the World Cup of 1999. So, Steve, I'm a youngster. I've left university. I've put all my savings into going over to the UK to follow the tour. And I get over just after Australia get through to the Super Sixes. So I was a bit nervous early. But then, me and a friend, Macca, We caught a bus from London to Headingley for the Super Sixes game against South Africa, and there was all these South African tourists in front of us, and they were giving us grief, saying we were going home. Lance Klusner was going to bash us out of the tournament. So I get to Headingley, and I see the greatest one day innings I've ever seen. 120 not out by yourself. Australia's World Cup future on the line. I've heard that the selector Trevor Holmes had said that if Australia misses the semi-finals, you were going to get the sack. Is that true?
Well, he didn't say sack, but reading between the lines, that was what was going to happen. So, yeah, I never minded that because I was always open and honest with Trevor, and we could have that dialogue, and you know, it didn't really affect me too much. In some ways, I probably needed that sometimes to get me motivated. So, he pretty much said that, but it didn't worry me too much. It didn't take my focus away, and in fact, probably steal me to perform better, so maybe you did me a favour.
That innings was just phenomenal. You seemed to be in the zone. I remember one shot, there was a slog sweep off you on one knee, maybe Elworthy was bowling.
Was, yeah.
And it went like a shot from a gun. A special day for you?
Yeah, I do remember that shot. It was probably the sweetest ball ever hit. I'm a quick bowler, taking the gamble, going down on one knee, and you're right, I hit him a long way. It was a big boundary, so it was one of the best shots I've ever played. But yeah, I think I look back at my career, some of the best innings I played were when it was like make or break, and I sort of said to myself, I got nothing to prove, and for some reason you go with a clear head, and maybe that's what they call being in the zone. I think it's hard to replicate that, but it's about just having the ability just to think about one thing and not a lot of things come into your head. So I was playing with a clear mind, felt great. Obviously had a bit of luck with Herschel dropping that catch. But yeah, I felt as if I was in control, and all through that innings, I had the inkling that we were going to win the game.
Oh, he hasn't waited for that. That's gone. That's six. And he's got cramp from the shot.
He recovered very quickly. Well, every now and again, Steve Waugh, just from nowhere, plays a fantastic shot. It's cross-batted, but it was in control. He knew where he wanted to hit it. And goodness me, hit it he did. He hit that out the screws. Which rose that? 17F.
Well, that's it. That's a magnificent century. A century played when the pressure was really on. He is a fantastic cricketer.
Obviously, then you get into the semi-finals and you're playing South Africa again in Birmingham. That particular matchup between that South African side and yours seemed to be a really fiery one. You know, the really two competitive sides going to battle.
Yeah, you played similar styles, no doubt about it. They're a tough team and full of superstars as well as we were. So probably two of the best quality one-day sides that ever played the game, really, when you think about it. And we were backing up like 2 days after that, so we were mentally fatigued. I mean, I was mentally very tired, and I'm sure everyone else was. So technically, it probably wasn't the greatest game, the semi-final, but emotionally and score-wise, it was, you know, being remembered as probably one of the greatest one-day games ever. You know,
oh, absolutely.
A roller coaster. Both sides could have won it 10 times, lost it 10 times, and we just end up tying the game. We didn't actually win it, we tied the game, so... But, yeah, it was an incredible game, and it was played on adrenaline because, as I say, both sides were very mentally, physically and mentally tired going into that match.
Now you'd probably be playing a super over to decide that game. I was one of those mad people running on from the sideline when Gilly took the bails off. I mean, just one thing that, you know, I've interviewed Damien Fleming on this podcast, and he was saying that, you know, he was bowling around the wicket and Clues had smashed him for two fours, and he said to you, "I want to bowl over the wicket, Skip," and you said, "I'll back you. You just do what you want." And a consistent message from your teammates and people you led was that you backed them. You know, where did that come from?
Oh, look, I think it came from actually being a bowler and having captains who would tell you where they wanted the field and probably giving you too much information. I always felt like, hang on, I've got the ball in my hand. Let me control the situation and trust me. So I always would listen to the bowler, and if he was convincing enough or I believed that he was positive and believed he could do that, and I'd go with it because he could control it. He had the ball in the hand, and that was the same with all the players. Keep it really simple. Don't complicate it. You get to that level, you're a good player. I'm not going to tell you how to play, but I'll give you confidence and the backing. I think that's what most people want. Even at the top level, they want to have someone who can reaffirm or back them up or just give them some positive vibes because you're after that 1%, and that's sometimes all it is. So, yeah, with Damien Fleming, I trust him. I said, "Look, mate, you do whatever you want, and fingers crossed, hope for the best," and it went our way.
That's right. But I think as well, you know, even in the Test side, you used to get more out of some players, Justin Langer, even Matty Hayden. I think knowing that their captain was fully behind them just lifted them a little.
Yeah, again, I just try to keep it really simple at that level. It wasn't about the big speeches on the table. It was telling guys, you know, how good they were, and I believe them, and giving the, you know, putting subtle messages with your journalists or newspapers where people would read stuff. And even before a match, if they'd read something positive in the paper, it might be just, again, that 1% that would give them the confidence to do well on the day. And sometimes putting players out of their comfort zone and, you know, maybe changing the order or bowling in a different way or putting in different field positions. But it was just trying to give people confidence that... that they could succeed in any situation. So again, I didn't want to complicate it because I knew they were good players anyway. It was just about giving that subtle bit of confidence behind the scenes.
And, you know, Shane Warne played such a huge role in that World Cup. He turned the semi-final, took four wickets in the final. Everyone I've interviewed about him says how amazing he was on the field. When, you know, you'd been in the Test side for 6-7 years when he first came in, how quickly did you twig on to the fact this guy's pretty special?
It was well before that. We went on a second 11 tour to Zimbabwe. I'm not sure what it was called, but it was emerging players. Mark Taylor, myself, and Tom Moody were the senior players. And Look, the first over he bowled, I was at bat pad and he bowled and I literally heard the ball fizzing as it went through the air and I'd never heard that before. I thought, geez, this guy's putting some revolutions on the ball, and he was a bit chubby in those days, but he had this straight away this incredible talent, and Victoria weren't playing him by coincidence. And I said, look, come to New South Wales, and I sorted him a job at the local RSL. He was about to come to New South Wales, and Victoria said, no, we want him to stay now. So, look, from the very first over I saw him bowl, he was always going to be different.
And then my final Steve Waugh moment.
But he could come back tomorrow. He could come back, have a good old Harmison, a bit of a loosener on the leg stump, pick it off the two.
Stuff the silver, we come for the gold. Poms have come back tomorrow. Aussies want it now. We're instant people. Come on, Stephen.
Now, Vaughan's coming in. And deep mid-wicket's coming in.
He's going to play the slog sweep. All three are going over, or he gets this 100. If Dawson pitches middle and off, he's in the frame. But so Steve Waugh, because he's just, you know, he's going to play this stroke.
Oh, this is...
It's death or glory off the last ball of the third day.
He's going to block it. 233 for five. Here we go. Dawson comes up and bowls to Waugh, who drives and drives through the offside for his 100. That is extraordinary. And Steve Waugh, a man of little emotion, can barely restrain himself now. His helmet's off. Oh, he's waving his bat. You could not have scripted anything more remarkable than what we have seen here this afternoon.
And it's the last ball century at the SCG. Well, 2003, just a magic afternoon. I owned a restaurant at the time and, you know, went from the ground to the restaurant and it was buzzing with your fans, Steve. So many people there talking about what a special day it was. And you were so emotional. You know, what's it like? You're coming to the end of your career. Everyone's sort of questioning what your role, but then you deliver and do it in such a theatrical fashion.
Yeah, well, it's something you sort of, you hope it's going to happen. And you still think there's that special moment left in your career and you've been training and you know it's there, but you've got people doubting and all of a sudden you start to self-doubt as well, but then when it comes off, you think, Jesus, such a relief, and it's so exciting and such a great moment, and it's a really good feeling. So for me, it was I wanted to celebrate with the crowd because really they supported me. They got me over the line when I think about it. That support was massive leading into the game, during the game. There was so much goodwill, and I really carried that in that innings with me. I just got out there again and said, I've got nothing to prove, just enjoy. It was like you know, a bit like some of the other innings where I played with a real clear head, and it was almost like I knew it was going to happen as long as I concentrated. But a lot of that was due to the fact of the spectators and the enormous support I had leading up to that match.
Oh, well, you were beloved at the SCG and still are. And a year later, you pull up stumps. How's retirement been?
Well, I don't know what that word means. I retired from cricket, but it doesn't mean you retire from life and challenges. So I just moved in different directions. Obviously, my charity, I'm very passionate about that. Business, family, and doing projects like this. I mean, I was lucky also to be involved in the Beijing and London Olympics as a mentor of the Australian Olympic team, and that was one of the great experiences of my life. Living in the Olympic Village for 3 weeks and seeing all those sports. Did something with the soccer team under Graham Arnold, obviously the Ashes mentor. This photography journey, so it's really been great that I've had the opportunity to explore other opportunities and to follow other passions. So I don't understand the word retirement. I don't think I'll ever retire. I think it, to me that means putting a cue in the rack, and I think that's when you go downhill. So I'll always stay active and always try and have a purpose with what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, Gavin Robinson, the last guest, said you like to be interested in things, so you're a passionate person. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Congratulations on your new book, and I'm looking forward to the Australian one coming out later this year.
Yeah, sure, and if anyone wants to get it, just log on to the website, stevewaugh.com.au, but thanks for your support.
Thanks, everyone, for listening, and a special shout-out to our Patreon subscribers. Also, great news for Apple phone users. You can now access the premium content on the Apple Podcasts app.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving at your desk. Maybe at the gym. But you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach. And see a rocket launch. or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.